Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, October 31st. Happy Halloween, everyone. And I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Actually, it wasn't really planned this way, so it's not really in honor of Halloween, but kind of luckily in keeping with Halloween, I'm really excited about this week's episode. I have a chance to chat with the author of Seven Skeletons, Lydia Pine. But before we jump into that, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week, and I also want to share some new updates about the Talk Nerdy store online, where I have some new goodies for you guys. Those of you who supported the show via the Patreon portal by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy, thank you once again. You guys really do make the show possible for everybody to download completely free of charge. So once again, I want to thank Phil T-Bear, Ron Kanoblock, Pedro Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, the Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but certainly not least, Jeffrey Sewell. I also want to thank those of you who support the show in other ways, like rating and reviewing on iTunes, sharing the show with your friends and family via social media, and visiting the Talk Nerdy store. If you are interested, you can go to carasantamaria.com and click through to the store. I have some new goodies up on the store, a new bundle with brand new leather bookmarks and keychains that are made by hand with the Talk Nerdy logo. And I'm really excited that I get to now sell copies of the Tiny Thinkers book, Charlie and the Tortoise. It's a beautiful, wonderful kids book about Charles Darwin as a child visiting the Galapagos and stumbling upon the theory of evolution via natural selection with his friend, the little dog named Hitch. Yeah, you like that nod? It's actually written by MJ Mouton. It's illustrated by Jezreel Cuevas. And I was lucky enough to be asked to do the foreword of this book. And there's a whole illustrated page dedicated to that. So this is available on my website right now. Also signed copies if you guys are interested. And if you use the offer code CHARLIE, you'll get 10% off of your entire order. Okay, guys, without any further ado, I'm so excited about this week's guest. She's the author of Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. Here she is, Dr. Lydia Pine. Lydia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's fantastic to be here.
I am so excited. So just for a little bit of context, for anybody listening, I actually met you, Lydia, at the Natural History Museum maybe like a month ago now, when you were there for this great book series that they're doing called Reading Between the Lions. Get it?
Right.
Lions. Because we did it in the hall, like the I think it was in the African Mammal
That's
Hall.
Right.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, with all the dioramas around us, really fun. So I got to moderate a little one-on-one with you for some museum guests, and I was obsessed, and it was really great, and your book is awesome. And so, yay, you're on the podcast now.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, yeah. This is really exciting. So you are the author of a new book called Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. When did it actually get published?
So the book came out officially August 16th, so just over 2 months ago.
Very cool. I've got, you know, like often happens, one of these uncorrected proofs, which I think is really cool because they're like collector's items. Mm. But they're also fun to read because you definitely find typos from time to time. I haven't come across any yet in yours, but definitely when I get books from authors before they're officially published, you know, it's the not quite final copy.
Right, right.
So before we jump into the specific stories within the book, I would love to start with just a little bit of background. Seven skeletons. So you chose seven different kind of famous or not so famous fossils to focus on in order to tell interesting stories about, I don't know, about what we know about our own human origins.
Yeah, that's right. I was really interested in exploring this question of what makes a scientific discovery famous. Why do some discoveries become famous? Why do they become celebrities? Why do they become known? All of these sorts of things. And so in order to look at that, in order to unpack that within the field of paleoanthropology and human origins, I opted to pick 7 fossils that I felt explored this question of celebrity in different ways. So I picked these 7 famous fossils and sort of unpack how and why they become famous and why they're different kinds of famous.
I love it because I love dead things. I love paleo. I love anything that's super old. It's fascinating to me. And also what I love is that you are a writer, but you are an anthropologist first, right? Or you're a historian of science who also worked as a paleoanthropologist. So you kind of come at this from so many interesting angles. Tell me a little bit about your education and how you got to be in a position where you had an authoritative voice to write this book.
Sure. So my background, my PhD is in history and philosophy of science. And I was really interested in the intellectual history of archaeology, of paleoanthropology, sort of how do we know what we think we know about old stuff, as you point out. And as an undergraduate and as an early graduate student, I had the opportunity to train in archaeology, in paleoanthropology, and in history. And so I really feel like this project is an opportunity for all of these different interests and all of these different threads to come together and to show, hey, these aren't sort of separate things, but they influence each other and they're all part of this sort of narrative knowledge-making process about how we think about fossils.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I would venture to guess then that most of the reporting, the researching that went into making this book didn't, or I don't know if it's most, but all of it didn't happen just when you got the, you know, the go ahead to write the book. You had already been really learning about these fossils and interested in them and studying them a long time before you actually decided to dive into the book.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that was really interesting as I was putting this book together was to realize how much these 7 fossils really become ingrained and sort of part of the history-making process. So while I was researching different parts of the archives that are associated with these fossils, I would come across things that I remembered from being an undergraduate. And to really realize that these stories and the process of understanding these stories really is sort of iterative, that it really builds on itself, and that sort of that recognition that these fossils have that kind of life history and that kind of temporal element to them, I felt was really important in unpacking that. But I have to laugh sort of at the sort of the science sort of you alluded to, okay, there's sort of this, you know, science nature of making the stories and writing the stories and researching these stories. I had to laugh about some of the fact checking that I had to do for some of the pop culture references to the fossils that pop up in the book. And one of my absolute favorite moments in fact checking the book and working with the editorial team in doing that was determining whether or not Elijah Wood wore prosthetic ears when he played a hobbit in Lord of the Rings. And I had this line in the book where I talk about sort of the world being ready to talk about small hominins because of the pop culture space that was allocated from Lord of the Rings. And so when I talk about Flo the Hobbit fossil, this comes up. And I remember just going back and forth about, you know, is this just a flip reference? You know, how could we fact check this? And I remember being so excited to not only fact check the, you know, the publications in Science and Nature from the scientific end of things, but to also be able to dig up an interview from Elijah Woods where he complained about the ears itching. And it just felt like this fantastic way that all of these kinds of knowledge about fossils are brought together.
Yeah, definitely the joys of journalism, right? And isn't it fun when, because I think some of the best science journalism is sort of, I don't know, like a convergent evolution in a sense, in that a lot of the people who write amazing science come from a lot of different backgrounds. So you have people who went to J school who found a love for science and decided to focus on that and kind of hone that ability. And then you have people who come from the sciences, right, who had to kind of learn about journalism as they went because they didn't get any formal education in journalism. And all these different backgrounds coming together to do that, I mean, this really is a journalistic piece, which is super cool considering that you were kind of more of a formal academic in your training.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true.
I love it. So first things first, because I can't remember if I got to ask you this when we were at the museum or not, but one thing that I struggle with when I do stories that are like anthropology stories on the podcast, especially on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which is another podcast that I work on, I feel like there's new naming conventions all the time. So I want to get straight. What is the difference between a hominin, a hominid, and a hominoid?
That's a really good question, actually. And it's definitely one where you're right. Sort of naming convention has changed over, has changed even over the last 15 years. So a hominin is any species of fossil primate that would be drawn closely into the Homo sapien family tree. And that sort of shows this evolutionary relationship between fossil species and sort of the species where we are today. A hominoid is going to include hominids, but it's also going to be expanded to include fossil ape species as well. So it's sort of a broader category. And a hominid is sort of the older taxonomic designation from a hominin.
Okay. And so, yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
like, I feel
exactly.
like when
There's
you look at
almost this like historical reading of the taxonomy of how it's being written and rewritten. So you sort of, I sort of think about them as like nesting dolls, and sort of the hominoid category is bigger than the hominin.
And people just don't really use the hominid convention anymore.
No.
It's just you read it in old papers, but now people say hominin.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay, cool. So, because I still say hominid all the time. So all I get to do is replace the D with the N. It's not that hard.
Exactly.
I will be mindful of that moving forward. So when we think of hominins, you know, we think of Homo sapiens first, modern man, modern human, modern woman, developed what, like 200,000 years ago, somewhere around there?
About 250,000 years ago is sort of the go-to point. 200 to 250,000 years ago is sort of the go-to point for archaeological evidence that sort of gives us a good starting point.
Cool. And then most of the hominin species that we hear about, that we see published in the literature, that you see like in, you know, popular science publications when there's a new discovery, are either within the kind of Homo sapiens lineage or outside of it, but they predate Homo sapiens. There's only a couple of early hominins that actually were kind of contemporaries, right, that were alive during the geological time scale, which is very short, that we have been alive.
That's correct. And sort of we see lots of species, lots of Homo species during the Pleistocene, sort of broadly from 2.6 million years to sort of the beginning of the Holocene. We see a lot of species, but you're right that very few overlap actually with Homo sapiens.
So Neanderthal is one of them, kind of famously, that we know
Absolutely. Overlapped
a little, and possibly the Hobbit species, the Homo floresiensis, right?
That's correct. Homo floresiensis is another one that researchers are pretty confident has overlap with Homo sapiens.
Cool. Well, maybe that's a good place to start, because you have seven skeletons. You have seven famous fossils within the book. You already mentioned Elijah Wood's ears, and we know that Homo floresiensis, of all of the skeletons in the book, all of the famous species, other than potentially the old man of La Chapelle, is potentially the the Hobbit species is potentially the youngest, right?
That's right.
So are you talking in the book about the kind of Hobbit as a whole, kind of a lot of different species, or a lot of different, I should say, specimens that make up this Homo floresiensis, or are you talking about a very specific fossil?
Sure. And that's a great question. So in the book, I do sort of profile Flo, the type specimen for Homo floresiensis. When I'm talking about sort of characteristics, behavioral characteristics associated with the species based on archaeological evidence, that of course is drawing from other specimens that have been recovered sort of to date when the book was published. So of course it's drawing on more than just Flo, but I really wanted to stick to this idea of profiling, writing a biography of a famous fossil and sort of sticking with that. One of the things that's been really interesting, however, is to see just how much archaeological research and just how much publication has come out even since the book has been published, since the book has been in press and published. There have been innumerable studies that have reassessed the dates that are associated with Flo, that have reassessed the behavior that's been associated with Flo, that have found other hominin remains other than Homo floresiensis potentially associated with Flo. And what really struck me with this, I mean, on one level, I sort of had this panic attack of, oh my gosh, the book, it's not even come out yet, and it's dated already. But what really struck me with that is this idea that these are under constant scrutiny, and that they are really, these objects, these fossils, are really participating in the scientific process of being under this constant scrutiny and being under this constant study. And it really felt affirming to have concluded the chapter with Flo, and to say that her kind of celebrity, her kind of space, is something that we're still working out. And that if we looked at some of these other fossils, these other famous fossils like Lucy or Piltdown or the Old Man of La Chapelle, and cut their story off at sort of their first 10 years, their first 15 years, they would look very different than sort of where we look at them now. And it felt that sort of the scientific process that's being associated with Flo right now is very much that she's following this kind of pattern that we see with these other famous fossils.
I mean, when I think of Homo floresiensis, I think of this tiny little, basically very close to Homo sapiens, just a diminutive version of Homo sapiens that didn't live very long ago. This is kind of the popular culture, I think. It's sort of this lost species on an island that sort of was able to continue to thrive even after most of its contemporaries would have died off. Is that an appropriate sort of idea, or is there a lot more to it than that?
I think that that's a really good starting place. And one of the things that has been reassessed rather recently is the dates that are associated with the fossil remains. And so originally the fossil had been published as being approximately 18,000 years old, which isn't very old in geologic time.
Oh, that's like after dogs were domesticated, you know?
This
like,
is a very recent aspect of the sort of the story of human evolution. And the second set of dates that were published last year have sort of reassessed that and pushed it back possibly as much as 100,000 years. And so it'll be interesting to see sort of what a third set of dates and a third set of analyses bring, and sort of, okay, where does that fall into? Regardless of sort of, though, I think where the date actually pins the species to, and sort of what range it offers for this species, more than just a single date, what range it offers. I think what's really interesting is the point that you brought up, that we sort of have this kind of narrative trope already for it, that it is this sort of lost species. It is this sort of, there is sort of a mythology or a mystique that surrounds it. And I think that that's really powerful in how the stories of it get told. I remember reading, in my research, I remember reading this absolutely brilliant essay by paleo artist John Gersh, who did the reconstructions of hominins for the Smithsonian's Hall of Human Ancestors.
Oh, I've been there, and it's beautiful.
Isn't it amazing? And so he's talking about putting together the reconstruction for Flo, and he describes it as this almost biblical sort of expression that he's looking for, that it's sort of this evolutionary sort of acceptance, that it's almost this foreordination, that she's looking at this erupting volcano and almost can see the end coming. And I felt that that was a really powerful set of emotions that he was talking about wanting to have in that fossil reconstruction there at the museum. And so those are the things that visitors are seeing, whether they're consciously seeing them or not. Those are the sorts of things that are packed into the story of Flo when we talk about that story publicly.
It's one of the, you know, when you look at the list of the seven skeletons that you profile, I think obviously the most famous of them all is probably Lucy, and we'll get to her soon. Flo, I actually didn't know that the type specimen specimen's name was Flo. I think that's pretty funny because it's, you know, just short for Floresiensis. But I didn't know that the type specimen was female. I didn't know that her name was Flo. But I think that that species as a whole is sort of captures the imagination of the public. And most people sort of know about the hobbit people on this island. But outside of that, I think that the other five skeletons that you profile are more kind of spotty in terms of does the public, I mean, obviously they're probably the seven most famous skeletons or close to the seven most famous skeletons or seven most famous specimens. But that said, some people know more about evolution in human history and some people know less. So some of them are actually, I think, to the general public, still a little bit obscure. Would you agree?
I think that that's definitely true. And I think that what I found to be incredibly interesting is that people have sort of their favorite fossil, and they'll know an awful lot about, you know, one or two or three of these. And of course, there are some absolutely brilliantly awesome fossil enthusiasts that know just about everything there is to know about all seven, of course. But what's interesting is that that people, I think, sort of attach and write onto and sort of become hooked onto, feel like that they have an association with some of these different fossils. And it's been interesting to talk to people and sort of start to pick apart, well, where does that come from? And so for a fossil, like we were talking about with Lucy, I think it's very easy to see that in just about every media discussion of any kind of human ancestral fossil, there'll be sort of this point of looking back to Lucy, that whatever we're talking about is going to be younger than Lucy, is going to be older than Lucy. You know, this species would have walked bipedally just like Lucy. And so I think that these fossils become subtly and not so subtly sort of part of our scientific education and part of the scientific discussion. And so I think what's most surprising is how much people don't know that they know about these fossils. Sort of the, oh, wow, you know, I know this Neanderthal caricature. I know the caveman stereotype. Oh, wait, I didn't realize, though, that is tied so strongly to the old man of La Chapelle. And so I feel like that there's a lot that people know and that this is sort of helping synthesize sort of where science and popular culture come together.
Yeah, that's true. Like maybe they actually know a lot. They just don't, they know it contextually and they don't know like the moniker, for example.
Exactly.
Like Lucy is just so easy. It's an easy word to say. It's recognizable. The story of how Lucy got her name, I think, has like staying power.
Absolutely.
And everybody can get that. Like a young child can pronounce it. Mm. Some of the others maybe are like harder to say, or you don't know how to pronounce it out loud. So even though you've read about it, it didn't stick because you haven't verbalized it, which is a common problem for people who read a lot of
absolutely.
Science.
Absolutely. No, absolutely.
So speaking of Lucy, I mean, I think maybe we can pivot to her a little bit.
Sure.
Because most people listening are going to be like, oh yeah, I know something about her. And also, by the way, I think the reason that Flo and Lucy really stick out in my mind is because they're chicks. Like, there's something cool about, we often think about science as having this long history that's, you know, not necessarily steeped in misogyny. It is steeped in misogyny, but it's also just steeped in a very, like, men did science for a long time, and so they had a very male-centric view. And when we think of fossils, we think of them as being men fossils, but no, of course, it's 50-50.
Like, well, and I think that
as many women as men.
Right, and I think that a lot of that comes from this idea that we talk about the evolution of man rather than the evolution of humankind. And so, in some ways, sort of having these female representative fossils is a way of sort of playing against that, even that jargon of just talking about the evolution of man, that I think that almost plays against type a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. And so, you know, Lucy is Lucy. She is female. She was, did we know she was female right away?
Yes, actually. Part of the fossils that were recovered were part of her pelvis. And so paleoanthropologists were able to assign her to a sex fairly early on in the study of the fossil.
That's good. Is it ever the case that it's kind of like when you adopt an animal or you get like a hamster or something and you don't know what its sex is when you first adopt it, and then later you end up with like a little girl cat with a boy's name because you couldn't tell the difference, you know? Has that ever happened? Or, I mean, I'm assuming it's happened, but are there cases where you find fossils and you don't have enough pieces to know whether it was male or female, but they kind of assign it a gender anyway?
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of it depends on what part of the fossils, you know, what part of the skeleton has been recovered. It also depends on how sexually dimorphic the species is, whether it's really easy to sort of sort males from females. But yeah, there's a lot of fossil bits out there that are sort of, you know, not assigned to a particular gender.
Because
it's just really hard. It's just fragmentary and it's really hard, and there aren't huge sample sizes in the fossil record.
Well, I like that. I like that they're not assigned. I feel like that's better than just either assuming they're all men, or if they're like little, they're women. And if they're big, they're men. You know, it's like, no, there's a little more to it than that. But so we know that Lucy was female. We know it based on her hips and based on some other information. Lucy, people might remember listening to the podcast. I actually had Don Johansson on the podcast, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, fantastic.
And so, yeah, if you want a little bit of a primer about that, you can go back and listen to Don talking about Lucy. We actually veered off course. We talked about Lucy a bit, but then we talked about like being atheists in science and like getting flack for that. But so he discovered her along with his team in Ethiopia in 1974. She was named for, obviously, the Beatles song, if you hadn't heard that story, by one of his researchers, right? One of his female grad students, I think.
That's sort of how the story is told now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think, so obviously that gives her a lot of significance. She has a cool name. She had a good PR campaign around her. She was really interesting because she has all of these like ancient kind of very ancient features, but then these very modern features at the same time. So she was a little bit of an enigma. Is Australopithecus afarensis thought to be in our direct evolutionary lineage, or is Australopithecus afarensis thought to be an offshoot where we had a kind of a common ancestor, but they evolved sort of in a different clade than we did?
I think that paleoanthropologists get very anxious about assigning sort of questions of direct ancestors. So I'll sort of waffle and preference the comment with that. I think that most family trees, most human phylogenies that you'll see drawn will show Lucy or Australopithecus afarensis in an ancestral relationship with Homo sapiens.
Okay. And do you think that that's part of why she is so celebrated and she's so kind of famous in people's minds, because we feel this direct connection to her?
I think so. I remember doing an interview that I talk a little bit about in the Lucy chapter. I remember doing this interview with the Bones Clones, which is the company that casts and creates replicas of fossils for university laboratories or schools or what have you.
What a great name, by the way.
Yeah, it really is. They're a fantastic company. They're really interesting, really smart. At different AAAS conferences, different anthro conferences, they bring, you know, the fully articulated Lucy skeleton to advertise for their company. It's really great.
Oh, cool. Yeah, because I don't even think I've ever seen. Most museums will either have replicas of the actual, because you know that famous picture we think of, it's on a black background, and we know exactly which bones were found and which ones are missing.
Yep.
So you'll either see a replica of that, or you'll see a bust of sort of what we think she looked like in the flesh.
Right.
But I don't know if I've ever seen
it. Yeah, it's really kind of interesting.
That's cool.
Because we think so much of Lucy looking just like you say, that static picture. That's what Lucy is. And suddenly when you put her in motion or you articulate her, suddenly it's this other kind of creature, and it's this other kind of object.
But you can really see like the long arms and the long fingers and like the kind of more what we think of as ancient primate features, even though there's so much about her that's so kind of human.
Right, right. And I remember talking to Bones Clones about Lucy and sort of, you know, how many of these famous fossils, how many casts do you sell? And sort of where do you see people you know, what are people buying the cast for, and you know, how much of this is going to education, and all of these sorts of conversations that we were having. Mm-hmm. And they kept emphasizing how much Lucy outsells just about every other fossil that they sell. And it was, and they said, and the interesting thing that the owner had talked to me about was the idea that it's this sort of African Eve, or this sort of almost maternal feeling that people had with the fossil. I mean, he was sort of joking and sort of speculating and sort of, you know, why do we sell so many Lucys? But it was, I thought, a really interesting point that I think dovetails into what you were asking of sort of, what is it about Lucy that gives us this kind of association? And I think that there is something sort of direct or maternal, or that, again, it is sort of, it's a story that's very easy to write ourselves into.
Yeah, it's true. You know, that I wonder if it would have been as popular, would have been as meaningful, if she weren't both in what we think of as a very closely tied lineage with Homo sapiens, and also female. It's like those two things together give that sort of natural mother, you know, that Eve, that maternal vibe to her that maybe would be missing if we didn't have both of those features. But you also make a very good point in the book, and also you did when we were speaking at the museum, that Lucy had a real good PR campaign around her.
One of the things that I loved tracking down in the research for this book was Lucy's first press conference. And I was so excited to track this down. So her first press conference is in 1974, in December of 1974, a couple of weeks after she's discovered. Johansson and others hold a press conference in Addis Ababa before Lucy is taken to be studied at the Cleveland Museum. And in this press conference, so before the researchers have assigned her a scientific name, before they've studied the bones, before she sort of has a scientific identity, they talk about the fossil as Lucy. And I love this idea that she had this Lucy persona, no matter what she was eventually going to be. In the scientific world, she was going to be Lucy. And that I think that was an incredibly powerful thing that happened, to be able to connect her with audiences.
And oh, for
that
sure.
Happens
she was Lucy
right off the bat. Before she's an Australopithecus, she's Lucy. Before
That's amazing.
Before she's, you know, Dinkanesh in Amharic, that means she is special. So before she even has an Amharic name or an Afar name or any of these other sort of cultural connections, she is Lucy. And I think that kind of creating that kind of identity has been one of the things that has made Lucy Lucy over the decades.
Do you think that there was any sort of tension around giving her this Western moniker before she even had an Ethiopian name or a more kind of culturally specific name to the location where she was found? Because of course, Ethiopia owns, right, the bones. Mm. And right. When Lucy would go on tour, they would have to kind of give permission for her to be borrowed, for people to be able to learn from her, because the bones don't go to the discoverer, they go to the place where they were pulled out of the ground. And she's like a prize in Ethiopia.
Oh, absolutely. And so actually, when Lucy was returned to Ethiopia in the early 1980s, she didn't leave the the National Museum at Addis Ababa. Actually, until 2007, she went on tour in 2007 to the United States and did a 6-year tour through the United States, went to Houston, went to Seattle, several other places in between. And that's the only time that Lucy has actually gone on tour and has been lent out. Other than that, researchers go to her, actually. She doesn't come to them. They go to her. And even access to that is difficult.
So do you think that there was some kind of, I don't know, like conflict when early on she sort of had this Western identity?
I think one of the things that's the most interesting, though, is that her identity is unfolding, and that she is, you know, so first of all, she's Lucy. Then she's Australopithecus afarensis, and the Afar part of her name, you know, refers to the Afar region where she was discovered. So there's, you know, in 1976, there's this sort of geographic tie to Ethiopia that's fairly immediate. And then sort of over the years since then, she's picked up these different names in Afar and in Amharic. And I think that that speaks to her constant staying power of she is going to connect with these different audiences and she is going to resonate on different cultural levels. But if you go to, when you fly into the Bulle International Airport in Addis Ababa, you see signs, you know, for Lucy. And so there is something about Lucy being Lucy that holds true even outside of her other names.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Lucy is incredibly special to us all. And, you know, the fact that she was named Lucy first and that there was so much attention paid to her really early on and all of these other reasons that we talked about makes her very special. But you didn't write a whole book about Lucy, and there are books about Lucy already. You wrote about some other fossils that I was actually less aware of. So I'll get back to kind of Piltdown Man and the Old Man of La Chapelle, because those I was a little bit more aware of. But Tongchild, I didn't know anything about. And I know Tongchild is really special to you. You even so sweetly gave me a little 3D printed Tongchild skull when we met at the museum, which I have on my bookshelf now in my office.
Oh, awesome.
So tell me a little bit about him.
Yeah, so the Tongchild was discovered in 1924 by Raymond Dart in South Africa. Raymond Dart was an anatomist. He was a fossil enthusiast, a natural historian, and he had gone to South Africa to establish the medical school and the medical curriculum at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And had this program where he would sort of have students bring him curious fossil primates. Well, curious fossils, but especially being interested in fossil primates. He was a neuroanatomist by training, and so was particularly interested in the question of sort of the evolution of the human brain. And so when he had a student bring him this fossil primate, he got really excited and sent a note to the owner of the mine where the fossil had come from, saying, "Hey, you know, any of these fossils, just send them to me. Send them along. I'm happy to pay for them," et cetera, et cetera. The owner of the mine, very generously on behalf of his workers, declined the monetary reward, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
And then eventually sent Raymond Dart this huge trunk full of fossils. And the story goes that Dart, this crate of fossils arrives for Dart the day that Dart and his wife Dora are hosting a wedding for one of Dart's friends, and Dart's supposed to be the best man. And, you know, sort of right as the wedding is supposed to get started, Dart sees the crate, starts rummaging around in the crate, and comes across a fossilized primate brain, a fossilized hominin brain. And he just, you know, in his memoir, in his autobiography, Dart just waxes eloquent for pages about how he was going to be, I think he calls it Darwin's instrument, in bringing, you know, the emphasis in human evolution back to Africa. And he's just ecstatic. And finally, the poor groom, you know, the poor guy who's actually waiting to get married here is like, "You've got to put the fossils away, and you know, or I've got to find another best man. I mean, we've got to fix this." So Dart, the story is that Dart puts the fossils sort of in his pocket and goes down and grudgingly sort of, you know, goes to the wedding and then, you know, comes back and starts playing with the fossils and studying the fossils and being excited about the fossils. And I think that one of the things that really struck me about the Tongchild specifically was this incredible story of discovery, and that it's almost reached this sort of mythical dimension of an origin story associated with a fossil that it's hilarious. I mean, you have this guy in full Edwardian attire sort of rummaging through a crate of fossils, not to be deterred from science for anything. And it sort of takes on this story of its own. And I think that that is one of the things that makes people really like the story of the Tongchild. And I think one of the other things that sort of draws people to the story of the Tongchild is that it's sort of this story of an underdog fighting the scientific establishment. So when Dart finishes cleaning up the Tongchild and sends it off to be published in Nature in 1925, he describes it as a human ancestor. He gives it a name, Australopithecus africanus. So again, tying it to Africa, South Africa.
Was this the first? It must have been the first Australopithecus.
It was, actually. Yeah. And even that name was horribly contentious when he published it because it mixed Latin and Greek and it was, you know, not proper nomenclature and blah, blah, blah. And so the scientific establishment, specifically in England, was just, you know, floored. What do we make of this sort of upright, bipedal, walking, small-brained hominin from South Africa? I mean, it didn't fit any of the accepted evolutionary theory at the time.
Then they probably weren't thinking of it as a hominin. They were thinking of it as just an ape.
Exactly. And that's exactly what the establishment said. They said, you've got some kind of fossil primate there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's curious, but it's not really interesting. And Dart really didn't do himself any favors when he was publishing The Tongue Child, because he wrote the treatise, and it's this sort of florid prose. I mean, it's just sort of over the top about, you know, the grandioseness of the discovery of man. And, you know, what the scientific establishment wanted were good photographs. They wanted caliper measurements. They wanted sort of data that they could, that they could work with. And what they got was this sort of, you know, grandiose
poetry,
right? And it's just, you know, what we can't make any sense of that. And so there was this real pushback against Dart. Even when he tried displaying a cast of the Tongue Child fossil at the Wembley exhibition in Britain, he didn't think to sort of have a private viewing or a private showing for scientists. And so eminent, prominent scientists sort of have to file past with, you know, the sort of unwashed masses of humanity to take a look at this fossil replica, and they're just completely unimpressed. And so for decades, Dart's discovery is dismissed as a human ancestor, and he's just sort of relegated to, you know, to working in South Africa. And sort of at the point that he gets serious about doing some very rigorous work, the scientific establishment, their attention has been caught up by other fossils at that point. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the Tongue Child has sort of missed its moment. And so for decades, it sort of is this South African curiosity. And then other scientists start working with it, scientists like Robert Broom, John Robinson in South Africa. And they find other hominin specimens that they tie to Australopithecus africanus. So because the Tongue Child was this juvenile, it's only 3 years old when it dies, it raises a lot of questions about how do you create a type specimen for a species based on a juvenile? What would an adult look like?
Yeah, because everything about it is super weird.
Exactly.
Like,
it hasn't developed. It hasn't. Yeah. Exactly. And so once these adult specimens start coming, you know, start coming into the fossil record, and once they're published, and once Piltdown, for example, is debunked as a legitimate mm-hmm. human ancestor, sort of all of these other historical factors start to coalesce in the mid-20th century to sort of add validity to Dart's argument that the Tongue Child is a human ancestor. And eventually, by the debunking of the Piltdown man, the Tongue Child steps in as sort of a good candidate. And by the time the Diamond Jubilee of the Tongue Child's discovery is celebrated, Dart has sort of been vindicated. It is accepted. And I think that that story, the sort of this vindication in the face of, you know, skepticism, I think has incredible mythical power and incredible sort of sway in sort of the making of how we talk about science. And I think that that's one of the reasons that the Tongue Child, more than other fossils that have been dismissed and then accepted, has sort of reached this kind of celebrity canon of fossils.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that come to mind listening to you talk about Tongue Child. First, it's how interconnected a lot of these discoveries really are, that we don't know much about one thing in a vacuum. We have to compare it to other things. So you were talking about its relationship to Piltdown and kind of like when Piltdown was debunked, Tongue Child was able to really be celebrated, which we'll get to Piltdown in a minute. But that's fascinating to me. Another thing that's really interesting is just tied to the fact that just this week on The Skeptic's Guide. It hasn't aired yet as of our conversation, but it will have aired by the time this podcast airs. It's very confusing. We time travel in podcast land. And it might have been this week. It might have been last week. So I'm not sure when this episode's going to air. But the word of the week, I do like a what's the word every week on Skeptic's Guide. And the word was taphonomy, this, you know, this study of how things fossilize, how they decay, how they're preserved, how they, how they assemble. And so I kind of dug into the etymology of it. And one of the things that I found is that the term and really the process itself was coined by a Russian paleontologist named Ivan Yefremov in 1940. And so we forget sometimes that, like,
I mean, it's Todd
Child
so
was discovered
recent.
In 24. I know, like,
exactly.
24, you know, it's all recent, but in the grand scheme of things, too, when you think about, like, you were talking about Victorian clothing, you know, we don't remember sometimes if Todd Child was discovered in 24, but they didn't even know how things actually preserve until,
and there's
like,
also, there's
1940.
No way to provide a radiometric date. I mean, today when we talk about a fossil being discovered, one of the first questions is, well, what does it date to? And that all of these sort of assumptions, the ways that we would validate or authenticate or sort of work out the fossil context, that's not available in 1924.
Yeah, it didn't exist. Yeah. And of course, people were still struggling to even accept Darwin's theories. I mean, obviously they still are now, but the scientific establishment was struggling to accept Darwin's theories early on. You know, this was all happening sort of around the same time. This was in sort of paleo,
it's definitely
paleontology.
Sort of, right, the sort of Wild West and the development of paleoanthropology as its own scientific discipline. And so
it was all very new to become
its own thing. And what is it that we study and what methods and what does it mean to know something and what would that look like? And so when DART sort of offers this, as you call it, sort of this prosaic poetry. I mean, it doesn't really have space until he goes back and does a lot more rigorous study.
But as a historian of science, you must have loved it.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So speaking of not having radiometric dating or really like solid ways to validate these discoveries, I think that's a really good transition to Piltdown Man, which we've discussed multiple times on the Skeptics Guide. So any of my followers who are crossover followers who are like true skeptics and who really love these stories of kind of bad science being overturned by good science, they already know about Piltdown Man. But people who don't, you know, they might not realize that Piltdown Man is in many ways one of the greatest scientific hoaxes of history.
Oh, absolutely. It is the longest perfpetrated hoax in the history of science, regardless of discipline, which I'm not sure, you know, quite how we take a bow, what that means, but it is, you know, the longest perpetrated hoax. And recent publications out of the Natural History Museum of London have sort of pointed to Charles Dawson as the perpetrator of the hoax. And by recent, I mean in August, actually, so very recent. But what I find fascinating, sort of as a historian, is the sort of unresolvedness of this hoax, and sort of why and who and what does this mean? And one of the things that I found to be absolutely fascinating in the research about Piltdown Man was just how much. All of the scientists that I talked to, how much each of them had their own pet theory about who had done it. And they would, you know, list the evidence. It's almost like you're creating this case, you know. So, you know, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, oh, clearly he was the perpetrator. Or Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, the inventor of Sherlock Holmes, clearly he's the perpetrator. Or Charles Dawson, you know, clearly he's the one who set up the hoax. And I found it fascinating that there's this, the sort of unresolvedness of Piltdown is in itself part of the identity of it.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, it turns out to be very Occam's razor in that
dude
who discovered it put it in the ground, right? Like, the guy who actually found it is the one who, you know, intentionally aged these modern fossils to make them look quite old. And it really wasn't one of these cases of mistaken identity, but a specifically planned and perpetrated hoax.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it makes you wonder why. I mean, people, he just really wanted to be famous because he did name the damn thing after himself.
Well, actually, so Arthur Keith named it, or excuse me.
Exactly.
Arthur Woodward Smith names, the fossil Eoanthropus Dawsoni, or Dawson's Dawn Ape. So again, you know, no need to aim low in your, you know, your grandiose expectations there. But what is fascinating is that Charles Dawson had this, you know, had for decades had been collecting and sending specimens to the museum. whether they were antiquarian specimens, whether they were fossils, whether they were archaeological artifacts. And so he had this relationship sort of built up between himself and Woodward Smith at the museum of sort of being a very good collector. And I think that today in science, we don't sort of remember that there is this long tradition of amateur collecting. Mm-hmm. So he is a very good collector. And I think that one of the things that really struck me in my research was just how much validation he wanted to be a fellow of the, you know, the Royal Geologic Society. And he wanted that sort of the celebrity and the notoriety and the sort of fame that went along with that. And I think that a fossil like Piltdown definitely ensured that.
Yeah, no, that's true. And, you know, it's funny because it really makes you think about the hallmark of the scientific process. What is so core to science is that what we once knew may not always be the case as we find new evidence. And in this case, once Piltdown was finally kind of put to bed and fully debunked, it makes you wonder how many graduate students or how many individual scientists needed to go back and look through all of his collections to ensure the validity of so much that he actually did contribute to science.
Right.
Because, you know, if somebody perpetrates a hoax that big, it makes you go, okay, shit, when did this behavior start? Where were these little tweaks? It reminds me in some ways, not in a guided way, but of another thing that we discussed recently on SGU, and it's going to be a spoiler. I'm so sorry, guys, because it's a science or fiction item. But again, it should have already aired by now, about a brand new study that showed that Capuchin monkeys actually will work with stone not in any sort of guided tool making, because that would be amazing, but that they'll bash these stones, and in doing so, slivers will fall off that are indistinguishable from early sliver stone tools of humans. And it's very hard now, like a lot of individuals are going to have to look back and say, shit, is everything that we thought was hominin, or is it an artifact of other primate behavior? And what are the context clues around? Do we know that this was in kind of a human or a hominin area, or is this just random sort of offshooting of behavior? And like, these kinds of things are amazing when they happen in science, because they make you stop and rethink and question what oftentimes is a paradigm at that point.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's stressful as hell, but it's really exciting, you know?
Right.
And so, I love the story of Piltdown Man, because not only does it have a million layers, it's a great kind of Sherlock Holmes story, but it also is, I don't know, it's fun for all. It's fun for the skeptics. It's fun for the true scientists and anybody who really celebrates like what you do, which is study the history and the systems of science. It's such a beautiful tale that shows you why the scientific method really does matter.
I really loved writing about Piltdown Man, and I thought it was interesting. I remember sort of going back and forth a bit with my editor, and we sort of had this conversation about, okay, you're talking about famous fossils, but this isn't really a fossil. You know, does it have space? You know, ought we to include it in this? And I sort of stepped back and I looked at that and I said, look, I'm talking about celebrity discoveries and sort of what makes a discovery, you know, a sort of a celebrity of its own paradigm, and what kind of influence can it cast? And I look at sort of the incredible sway and explanatory power that Piltdown held for decades. And so that was sort of the tipping point for us to include the fossil as sort of the celebrity making. What are the consequences? We create these celebrity discoveries. What are the costs that come with that?
Oh, I'm so glad that you did, because it's just it's such a compelling story. So we're not going to get to all seven, which is good, because we got to leave them wanting more. You've got three left that we haven't talked about yet: the Old Man of La Chapelle, Peking Man, and is it Sidiba or Sediba?
Sidiba.
Okay. Which of the three do you think that you want to close with?
I think I'm partial, and I'll pick the Neanderthal. Actually, I'm a little partial to the Neanderthal. So let's go with the Old Man of La Chapelle.
All right. So he is not the type specimen of Homo neanderthalensis. Did I say that right?
Yes, and you're correct. Okay. And he's not even the first discovered Neanderthal.
But he is the first Neanderthal that was discovered in ground, kind of in the ground intact, right?
Absolutely. So it's the first complete Neanderthal skeleton that's found in situ. All of the previous Neanderthal discoveries before that had come out of mines, sort of as workers are blasting out mines, they come across, you know, Neanderthal fossils, which is where the first Neanderthal, the type specimen, comes from.
And so there's no context.
There's no context. It's just exactly. Bones. It's just, you know, hey, here's something kind of weird looking. and so once the Neanderthals, though, sort of gained their own species in 1865, and the first Neanderthal was discovered in 1856, these older museum collections that had these sort of curious bones, they begin looking back through them, and they find some of these Neanderthal bones to be part of this new species. And so it offers, so when the Neanderthal species is first described, it offers a little bit of intellectual space for museum collections to sort of reassess what it is that we have. And so a few other Neanderthal bones sort of come up in this process, but you're absolutely right that there's no context. It's just, well, here's the fossil, and that's cool and that's interesting, but that's not as cool and as interesting as finding something in situ. We can know a lot more about the fossil and its species when it's discovered in situ than we can from a museum collection.
And the newer and more kind of culturally relevant, not culturally relevant, that's not the right way to put it, more embracing of culture the species is, like Neanderthal was, like, it had culture. Like, we now know that. It was very modern in many ways. Not only when you find something in situ, you might know more about its stance, or you might know more about, you know, how it died, but you might also find, like, artifacts around it that you never would find if you're just kind of blasting these bones out of the walls.
Exactly.
But, okay, I have to ask, before we even get into the old man of La Chapelle, because he wasn't discovered until 1908, you said the type specimen was discovered in the mid-1800s. What did people think it was? Did they think it was like a kind of just a weird human, or did they think it was like an ape?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. And so when it's first discovered, the local mine workers in the Neander Valley bring it to Johann Fulbrot, who's a secondary school teacher. And so he had some formal university training in natural history. And so they bring him this thing and they say, we think it's a cave bear. And he says, no, it's not a cave bear. It looks kind of human, but I don't know exactly what it is. So he takes it to a professor at the University of Bonn, and they study the fossil together. And they basically describe it. They don't quite say that it's a new species. They sort of waffle and equivocate and sort of aren't quite sure, because they just have this one. I mean, they have part of a skull. They have part of a femur. I mean, they don't have a great sample to draw from, but they say that it's very old, that it's very ancient, it's sort of human-like. And then eventually, Scottish paleontologist William Gregory King describes Neanderthals. He gives the term Homo neanderthalensis several years later, and sort of creates the taxonomic space for an individual species at that point.
And Homo means that it's, you know, it's human-like.
Exactly.
It means that it's not like more like one of the other great apes,
exactly.
But it's somewhat like us.
Exactly. So at that point, there's the sort of taxonomic and nomenclatural space for this other species to exist. But right off the bat, it's interesting, because I think it provides this sort of fantastic fossil foil. So we've talked about sort of, you know, human and Homo sapien, and we sort of have all of these things that we associate with being Homo sapien, you know, culture and sophistication and tool use and sort of all of these things. And for a lot of the decades in early Neanderthal studies, there was this sort of projection and this idea that this wasn't a species that could survive, that it was sort of, you know, not smart enough to evolve all of the wonderful things that Homo sapiens have sort of dreamed up. And so for it almost, I think, sort of took on this life of a cautionary evolutionary tale of sort of, you know, this is what happens. when you're not, you know, technologically savvy enough to keep up with the Pleistocene. And what's been fascinating, I think, in recent decades is the sort of the counter to that and the pushback against that and all of the archaeological work, as you point out, that's gone into reassessing this, that Neanderthals do have culture and they do have sophisticated tool use. And there is, you know, art and abstract thought and, you know, burial of the dead and all of these things that we so closely associate with human behavior. Suddenly we strip away more and more, and we're left, I think, with more similarities than differences.
It's so cool to think about these things in historical context, because like when you're describing these decades after the first discovery of Neanderthal, where individuals were thinking, oh, this is a cautionary tale. Oh, it wasn't very smart. It was like, it's got this like caveman kind of brutish.
This troglodyte, you know, that's sort of, you know, dragging
yes,
its knuckles
vibe
across the glaciated Europe. I mean, it's not.
It's funny because these are the same scientists who are actually very forward thinking, who are accepting that evolution actually happened and it happened for humans. Mm-hmm. Because this was not a comfortable idea. Even when Darwin first presented evolution, he kind of waited to talk about humans. You know,
right.
He kind of knew it, but he didn't want to talk about it overtly because he knew it wasn't going to go over very well. It's one thing to accept that like other creatures evolve. It's another thing to think that like, you know, man who was created in God's image evolves. So obviously just accepting that Homo neanderthalensis was a product of evolution was incredibly forward thinking. So to think or to have an expectation that they could imagine a species that was nearly as sophisticated, if not as sophisticated as Homo sapiens living contemporaneously, fuck. I mean, I'm impressed that they were as kind of forward thinking as they were.
It's fascinating to see that sort of forwardness, though, reflected in the depictions of Neanderthals in art in museums.
Yeah,
and so you have some, and I loved putting together these sort of early depictions of Neanderthals in the book. And so you see some artistic representations of Neanderthals where it's almost painful and it's almost funny to look at today, where it's, you know, just this, you know, just barely able to drag his club across, you know, his cave.
Yeah, like they're basically bonobos. Like they don't look at, you
right.
know, what they've got.
Right.
They're very, very ape-like in many ways, much more ape-like than they are. And I keep saying ape-like. Humans are apes, let's make that clear, but much more like the other great
right.
apes than like humans.
Right, but even in the 1920s, you have some paleo artists like Charles Knight who offer these sort of these beautiful sympathetic portraits of sort of, oh, these poor Neanderthals, you know, and they're beautiful sort of family done landscapes where you see, you know, groups of Neanderthals working cooperatively, but there's still this sort of sense that they couldn't quite make it. And I think that the evolution of sort of museum exhibit displays and the depiction of Neanderthals has been one of the biggest things to change in the sort of 100 years of Neanderthal studies.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the Human Origins Hall at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History in D.C. Stunning, because it kind of goes through all of these different types of specimens, and then there are these beautifully created busts
right.
that are at sort of the right height
yep.
for where the stature would have been, and it's, you can look into the eyes of your ancestors. It's amazing.
One of the things that I love about that that particular bust at the Smithsonian is the Neanderthal is the only one with styled hair. And it's this fantastic.
Because it would be the only one with styled
hair. But it's this
hair.
Fantastic, again, these sort of subtle, these subtle details that we add into reconstructions or that artists add into reconstructions that sort of work to create these similarities rather than differences.
Yeah, because there's no reason to think if they painted shells and wore them around their necks, there's no reason to think that they wouldn't do something to keep their hair from bothering them. You know what I mean?
But again, it's like, just these like beautiful, like subtle changes
yeah.
versus the older dioramas from the 1930s that you see at the Field Museum of Chicago, where, I mean, it's just, like I said, you have, you know, a Neanderthal that can barely even hold a tool.
Yeah, and is so barbaric and just so like animalistic in so
right,
many ways.
Right.
Ah, stunning. So there are two more that I mentioned. There's Peking Man and Sidiba, who are very well detailed in the book, which we aren't going to get to. You got to leave them wanting more. I put a note on this cheat sheet that I have here, which, yeah, guys, I have a cheat sheet for sure. I didn't know all this stuff offhand. I can't pronounce it. I want to call it Homo Naledi because that's how I've read it, but it's Naledi.
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
From the Rising Star Cave. This is one of those things where, like, this discovery happened while you were already in press, right?
Exactly. Again, it was just, wow, it's such an unfolding science that it, I think, is practically impossible to sort of write a book that's, okay, here is where we're at now. You know, here's what the latest science is. And one of the things that struck me is every single fossil that I wrote about had a major study come out in the time that this book was in press. And that,
crazy.
It was fascinating to see sort of how fast it changes. And it really made me excited that I had opted to take this angle of, okay, we know them, but why do we know about them? Why do we want to know mm-hmm. more about them? And why do we see so many studies about these particular fossils coming out? That it really,
yeah,
I
really
felt that it affirmed this idea that we do create celebrity scientific discoveries.
And it reaffirms how they really are in many ways keystone fossils
yeah.
because even something that was discovered in 1908 is continuing to have modern published research about it,
yeah.
which is so freaking cool. So, okay. I want to close, or actually I was going to say before that if you wanted to include Homo Naledi, you'll just have to write 7 more skeletons.
I agree. I think that seems to be the thing, is that 7 more skeletons would kick off with Homo Naledi.
That would be awesome. Before we end the conversation, I ask every guest on the podcast to answer the same 2 questions. And I'm always fascinated by their answers because my guests come from, you know, very disparate backgrounds and disparate fields of study. So I'm going to ask you the same ones. I apologize in advance that they're kind of big picture. So putting you on the spot a little bit. Okay, so here's where they are. When you think about the future, in whatever context that matters to you, whether you're talking about your own personal journey or whether you're talking about, you know, Homo sapiens here on, you know, planet Earth, the question would be, what is first the thing that most concerns you, most keeps you up at night, most worries you? But on the flip side, what is the thing that you're most sort of hopeful and optimistic about?
Those are big picture questions.
I know, I'm such a jerk.
Let's see. Okay. So I think that sort of the thing that would keep me up at night, the thing that I would worry about, and I would preface both sort of my answers, both of these, by saying that as a historian and as someone who looks at sort of at the really long durée of history, the sort of really long time scale of history, I would say the thing that would concern me the most would be sort of the lackadaisical approaches and attitudes toward climate change. And mm-hmm. one of the things that really, I think, comes through by studying paleoanthropology and looking at the history of paleoanthropology is looking at just how ecologically fragile and how incredibly ecologically contingent the sort of geologic story of human evolution is. So I would say that that's probably the thing that would keep me up.
Sure.
And I think the thing that would make me the most hopeful, though, is sort of looking at the sort of continuing curiosity about understanding our origins and the sort of the incredible historical sway and the commitment to wanting to know more that I see coming up again and again with fossils like this. That as we were talking about, we are still studying them and we are still finding questions to ask. And I find that curiosity incredibly affirming.
Wonderful. Those are great answers. All right, Lydia, this was so much fun. Before you go, I want to first let everybody know that they can buy 7 skeletons like wherever books are sold. Let everybody else know, you know, how do they say hi on social media? Where are you the most active? Is there a place where they can go to read more of your work? You know,
sure.
How can they sort of learn more about you?
Sure. So probably the most active social media would be through Twitter. And that would, my handle would just be my name, Lydia Pyne. And I post there rather frequently, different fossil studies, different sort of history of science stuff. So if you're interested in fossils and history of science, I post there a lot. I also run a blog through my website, which is pynecone, so pinecone.org. It's a reminder of sort of how to pronounce my last name. I post there through the blog. So if you're interested in sort of how historians work with primary sources or what historians of science do, that's where I publish stuff like that. The last blog post I had was sort of top 10 medieval taxa of sort of different top 10 homo of the medieval world. So yeah.
Crazy. I love it. All right. So guys, you can read more of Lydia's work on top of the book, which I know you're all going to go pick up. And you can reach out and say hi on Twitter and let her know that you loved this episode. Lydia, thank you so much for joining me. This was so much fun.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.